Once again, it's a delight to be here, a true joy to be with other Christians who have gathered together today to worship the Lord our God. Very much appreciate your presence here today, appreciate your attention. Okay, I just figured out who's here. It just keeps surprising me. People just pop up everywhere. Anyway, good to see the Harrises. But anyway, great to see you today. I have just thoroughly enjoyed the weekend here with you. You've been such an attentive audience, such a kind group of people. I've appreciated your hospitality. I've appreciated your encouragement, and I hope I've given you something to hang on to as well. God doesn't always use fancy people or fancy things to accomplish his purposes. Over in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, the Apostle Paul makes a comment about the difference between God's wisdom and man's wisdom. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, starting in verse 26, "For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women..." No, that's Romans. It helps if a person can read. I'm the product of a fine Arkansas education. Now, you can say what you want to, but at least we're not as bad as Mississippi. But anyway, I'm sorry. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 26, "For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong. And the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, so that he may nullify the things that are, so that no man may boast before God." God doesn't need us to fix his problems. God doesn't need us. He uses us, but he doesn't have to have us to accomplish what he wants done. And one of the hallmarks of redemptive history is that sometimes God picks some awfully insignificant people, people who were insignificant by every worldly standard you can imagine. They weren't the smartest, they weren't the richest, they weren't the most influential, sometimes they weren't even the most moral people. But God can use them to accomplish his purposes. And the story I want us to talk about today is the story of a woman by the name of Rahab the harlot. She starts out as a harlot in the story. She becomes, I think, one of the most significant women in the Bible. In a very subtle way, in a way that in many ways isn't even obvious. And part of her story, we don't really see the fullness of it until a long time after she's gone from the story. A woman who, in terms of conversion, she started out as a harlot and became a heroine in many ways in the biblical story. So I want us to talk this morning about, as we continue our study of conversion, I want us to talk about Rahab the harlot. So first of all, the story of Rahab is basically Joshua chapter 2. So turn to Joshua chapter 2. When you get to Joshua chapter 2, there's several chapters before the Israelites actually go into the promised land. They cross the River Jordan at some point, and they kind of set up camp just on the fringe of the promised land. It's not until chapter 6 that the story of Jericho takes place. And then after that, there's a few more things before they finally get in and start defeating the enemies and conquering cities and that kind of thing. So there's a whole lot of preparatory stuff in the opening chapters of the book of Joshua. Part of chapter 2 is to give some encouragement to Joshua. You go back to Joshua chapter 1, in verse 1, "Now after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' servant, saying, 'Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, cross this Jordan, you and all the people, to the land which I am giving you to them, to the sons of Israel. Every place on which the sole of your foot treads, I have given it to you, just as I spoke to Moses.'" And he goes on to describe the extent of the territory. Verse 5, "No man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life, just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. and I will not fail you or forsake you. And here's one of the hallmarks of this book. Be strong and courageous. Take courage. Be strong. Do what I tell you, and everything's going to be just fine. I will conquer the land for you. Now, there's a little bit of paradox about that. So why have an army? Well, they did have an army, and they did fight some battles, and sometimes they fought some hard battles. But ultimately, God was saying, I'm going to give you the victory. I will give you the land. I promised this to Abraham, first study we had in this series. I made a promise to Abraham centuries ago. I'm going to keep my word. Now, every time I read that, verse 2, Moses, my servant, is dead. How would you like to be the successor to Nick Saban? Now, there's always coaches out there who have a big enough head to say, of course, you want me. If I'm Joshua, Moses is dead. You're the next head coach. If I'm Joshua, I'm saying, oh no, what have I done? How did I get this job? Now, it's interesting if you look at Joshua. Joshua has a prehistory. Long before we get to the book of Joshua, Joshua makes quite a few appearances in Exodus and Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. He shows up at key places in the story. He had been preparing for this for 40 years. So he had 40 years of preparation. He was side by side with Moses. I think he learned a lot of lessons from Moses, but now reality kicks in. He's now the leader of the nation. Moses is dead. So Joshua, go do what you have to do. So he has given all of this encouragement in chapter 1, but then we get to chapter 2. All right, next up is this really hard city of Jericho. So they got to figure out, how are we going to do this? Now, he hasn't told them exactly how he's going to help them win the land. There is an army. That was the whole purpose of the census that they took. Was to find, at the beginning of the 40 years, at the end of the 40 years, there was a census. It was a military census. We're told that. All the men 20 years old and older who are able to go to war. So it's implied that an army is going to be necessary to do this. But exactly what part the army is going to play, exactly how God is going to use them, that isn't clear yet. But he wants to give him some encouragement here in chapter 1. We're getting ready to go into the land to fulfill the promise that was made to Abraham. Joshua, you're in charge. Take courage, be strong, be courageous. We're going to get this done. And I think chapter 2 is simply an extension of that. It gives him some encouragement when he sends the spies in, they come back with a report. That's really what Joshua 2 is about. After the introductory part of chapter 1, then he assumes command. Then in chapter 2, you've got the story of sending the spies in. Part of that is the purpose of giving this encouragement to Joshua. He's going to hear some news. That's really what Joshua 2 is about, confirming that they can go into the land, take it. Jericho's the first objective. Rahab, in a way, is really a secondary part of the story. And yet, in many ways, she's the central part of the story. You have that a lot in biblical narrative. It will tell us the story about someone, but the story really isn't about that person. It is how God uses that person. It's what God does to or for that person. And that's what we have here in Joshua chapter 2 as we go to it. Now chapter 2 begins in this way. So let's look then at the story of Joshua chapter 2. Then Joshua the son of Nun sent two men as spies secretly from Shittim, saying, go to the land, view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came into the house of a harlot, whose name was Rahab, and lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land. And the king of Jericho sent word to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And she said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. It came about that when it was time to shut the gate at dark, the men went out. I do not know where they went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them in the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued them on the road to the Jordan, to the fords, and as soon as those who were pursuing them had gone out, they shut the gate. So this is how the story begins. Basically, the spies arrive at Jericho. They are sent in. This is an interesting thing. Joshua sends the spies into the promised land. 40 years earlier, Moses sent Joshua and some other spies into the promised land. Went to a different access point. But it's kind of interesting because when the spies went in the first time back in Numbers chapters 13 and 14, they brought back basically a favorable description of the land. What they didn't bring back was a favorable description of the occupants. The land they liked, the neighbors not so much. And you get that. You've been in bad neighborhoods before. You love the neighborhood, don't like your neighbors. And that was the issue for the Israelites in Numbers 13 and 14. Okay, love the land, but these people, they are fierce. They're big. They're nasty. We're just not sure we can do this. And as a result of their lack of faith, they were punished for 40 years. They wandered in exile or in the wilderness for 40 years. Now, 40 years later, Joshua sends some more spies into the promised land. We're not told the name of the spy. I don't really know who they were. I'll talk about that a little bit later. But he sends two men in the city of Jericho. Now, I don't know exactly how espionage worked back in the time of Joshua. Now, I've read a lot of spy novels, but I think it's a little bit different. But the whole purpose is you go in and gather intelligence. That part is the same. But very quickly, the king knew something about it. I'm sure they had spies and counter-spies and all of that. So they had people watching the Israelite camp. There's a reason for that, because they've heard about who these Israelites are. So the king knows that some spies have come into the city. I don't know if it was how they were dressed. I don't know if they were just watching people at the camp, the Israelite camp, and just kind of followed them along the road. But Jericho was a key point. It was at the convergence of several highways, several key highways in the land. So strategically, Jericho was an important place. So I can understand why the king is concerned. You got this massive group of people just down the road, and they're sending spies into here. So they go into Rahab's house. We're introduced to her here. We're told in Joshua chapter 1. So they go to Jericho. They came into the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab, and they lodged there. She's called a harlot, and that word simply means she was a prostitute. And you look in the New Testament, and it uses similar language. She was a prostitute. I've seen some commentaries that say, well, this may have been more like a hotel. This wasn't a hotel. She was a prostitute. That's what she did for a living. Now, maybe she had been forced into that. Maybe she was a POW from a war earlier. I don't really know her circumstances. Maybe she came from generations of prostitutes. Maybe her mother, I don't know. I don't really know her story. I suspect they went there for some anonymity. Men would go in and out of this house quite a bit. So maybe they just go there and kind of get lost in the crowd. But the king knew it. The king knew that they were there, and so he sends some of his men. He sends them to Rahab. They come here to search out the land, verse 2. He sent word to Rahab. He knows why they're there. He knows most likely what's going on. So bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out the land. But she had taken them and hidden them and said, they were here, but they left and don't really know where they went. She lies. Now, sometimes we have a tendency to romanticize Bible characters. I was doing some reading last week and week before just on the story of Rahab. And this one guy was obviously trying to paint her into a more heroic character than she is, at least at this moment. He said, this obviously shows that this was a very trustworthy woman, because the king sent his men there and he knew he'd get the truth from her. And they trusted her so much they just took her at his word. No, it means she was a really good liar. That's exactly what it means. Either that or the king's men were super gullible, and maybe there's a little bit of both going on. But she just flat out lies. They swallow it, they go away. She's hidden the men on her roof. All kinds of stuff went on people's roofs back in those days. They used it for, sometimes people would sit there, sometimes they would read, sometimes they would pray, sometimes they would gather there. She has some flax laid out. Flax was a fibrous thing. If you've ever had a piece of clothing that's made out of linen, real linen, it's made out of flax. Similar to cotton, it's a natural fiber. But anyway, it's a very common crop back in the ancient Near East. So she has some spread out, and it's drying probably. So she's hidden them up there. They don't even think to look on, what kind of soldiers are these? I mean, if you've ever read a spy novel, you know people hide. So anyway, they don't even think to look on the roof. But anyway, she successfully hides them. And that kind of sets us up for what's going to happen in verse 8. So they arrive at Jericho. The king looks for them. She diverts them in a different direction. But this is really the heart of this chapter, starting in verse 8. Before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. Now when we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on the earth beneath. Now therefore, please swear to me by the Lord that since I have dealt kindly with you, that you will also deal kindly with my father's household, and give me a pledge of truth, and spare my father and my mother and my brothers and my sisters with all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death. So the men said to her, our life for yours, if you do not tell this business of ours, and it shall come about when the Lord gives us the land that we will deal kindly and faithfully with you. They went there to gather intelligence, and bingo, they got it. Now, as I said, going to a harlot's house, at one level, it's a place of anonymity. On the other hand, probably Rahab knew everything in town. She knew everybody. She knew every secret. She knew what was going on. And they came to the right source. When you look at what she says, this is, I think, one of the most remarkable confessions of faith anywhere in the Bible. The Canaanites had religion, but it was pagan religion. It was primarily superstition is what it was. They worshiped false gods. She doesn't really speak in terms of her gods. She talks about the God of the Israelites. Now, when she says in verse 9, I know that the Lord has given you the land, she uses the covenant name Yahweh. That's interesting. How had she heard that? My guess is because when they defeated the Egyptians and when they defeated Sihon and Og, the Amorite kings on the other side of the Jordan River, back in ancient times, warfare was a contest between gods. Yes, armies were involved, but it was the God of the Israelites versus the God of the Amorites versus the God of the Egyptians. So I'm pretty sure that at some point they had heard the name of Israel's God, Yahweh. I know that Yahweh has given you the land and that the terror of you has fallen on us, that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. How did she know that? Look at verse 10. We heard what the Lord did to Egypt, and we heard what the Lord did to the two Amorite kings. When did they hear about Egypt being defeated? 40 years earlier. This wasn't something that happened a week ago. This is something that happened a generation ago, and the people in Jericho were still talking about it. And they were probably aware that for 40 years the Israelites had been wandering around from place to place in the wilderness, and now they're on the doorstep. The same group of people who had marched out of the land of Egypt under the protection of their God, they're now standing at their doorstep. And more recently, this goes back to Numbers chapter 21, when the Israelites defeated Sihon and Og. They're simply trying to pass through their land, try to get permission to do that, and these kings said, no, you're not passing through here, so they go to war. and the Israelites win. So even more recently, they had defeated two powerful kings. I don't really know much about Sion and Og. I've tried to find some information. There's not a lot of information out there about those two men. But from her reaction, I would judge that they were powerful, powerful kings. And it was pretty impressive that this nomadic group of Israelites had been able to defeat them in their own land. And now this huge Israelite group is camped out at their doorstep. We heard about it. We know about your God. We know what he's done for you. And we're afraid. So she confesses that right up front. But then she says, now, I've told you something. I want something from you. You wanted something from me. I gave it to you. I want something from you. When you come and conquer this city, and I know you're going to do it, I want you to protect my family. So that is her testimony about what's going on. That's the intel that they've been looking for. Then she makes this bargain. It's elaborated on in verse 15. She let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall, so that she was living on the wall. She said to them, go to the hill country so that the pursuers will not happen upon you. Hide yourselves there for 3 days until they return. Then afterward you may go on your way. The men said to her, we shall be free from this oath to which you have made us swear, unless when we come into the land you tie this cord of scarlet thread in the window through which you let us down, gather to yourself into your house your father, your mother, your brothers, and all your father's household. And it shall come about that anyone who goes out of the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we shall be free. But anyone who is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head if a hand is laid on him. But if you tell this business of ours, then we shall be free from the oath which we have made us swear. You have made us swear. And she said, according to your words, so be it. So she sent them away and departed, and she untied the scarlet cord in the window. So they make this bargain. She said, this is what we're going to do. She proposed it, they agreed to it, but they said, now you make sure that when the city is destroyed, your whole household is in your house. Make sure you don't tell anybody about it, and tie this scarlet thread, rope, I'm not sure what it was. We think about a scarlet thread. I think it was bigger than a standard thread that you put on your sewing machine. But whatever it was, put this thing so we can identify you. We can find you. And she said, that's what we're going to do. And then finally in the story, the spies returned to their camp, verse 22. They departed and came to the hill country and remained there for 3 days until the pursuers returned. Now the pursuers had sought them all along the road but had not found them. Then the two men returned and came down from the hill country and crossed over, came to Joshua, son of Nun, and they related to him all that happened to him. They said to Joshua, surely the Lord has given all the inhabitants into our hands. Moreover, all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before us. That's exactly what Joshua wanted to hear. It ties in with the theme of giving him encouragement back in chapter 1. It ties in with the theme that God is in fact going to deliver the land into their hands. He will keep his word to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The purposes of God will be fulfilled. The Israelites will take possession of their home. So these first two chapters are really, really important. And Rahab is one of the central characters in this. So what kind of legacy does she leave behind? Well, first of all, she did get delivered. Go to Joshua chapter 6. So in Joshua chapter 6, toward the end of the chapter, you remember the thing that they marched around the city? And I'm thinking, if I'm Joshua, Joshua's a military guy. This is not how you conquer cities. Just walking around and shouting and blowing horns. But that's exactly how God wanted it. It was a miraculous deliverance. Now again, later in the book of Joshua, they had to fight some fights. They had to fight some hard fights. I think he gave them the city in this way right off the bat. First of all, to show, you think Jericho's a powerful place? It's not. I can make it fall just like that. Jericho was a fortified city. It was in a strategic location. It's one of the oldest known cities in the world. Been around a long, long time. And very few people have been able to actually conquer it. So God sends them in, and he defeats it not with some fierce battle, but they march around and they shout, and the city falls. I think that left a huge impression, not just on the Canaanites, but on the Israelites. They needed to see the power of God. So the city falls. So in Joshua chapter 6, Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, "Go into the harlot's house, bring the woman and all she has out of there as you have sworn to her." So the young men who were spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and her brothers and all she had. They also brought out all her relatives and placed them outside the camp of Israel. That's interesting. They're not Israelites, so they put them outside the camp. They were unclean. They were foreigners. So at least at this point, they're not in the camp yet, but they allow them to stay with them. They protect them. She did exactly what she promised. But look at the extensiveness of that. Her mother, her father, her brothers, all of her relatives, all of their stuff is saved by Joshua and his soldiers. They burned the city with fire, all that was in it, only the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. However, Rahab the harlot and her father's house and all that she had, Joshua spared, and she has lived in the midst of Israel to this day, for she hid the messengers whom Joshua had sent to spy out Jericho. She remained with Israel. And we're going to pick up more a little bit on that. At some point, she and her family were assimilated into Israelite culture. Not really said anything here, but the fact that she continued on with Israel says something. But as you read a little bit further in the Old Testament, we come to the story of Ruth. The whole point of the book of Ruth, that there's several messages there, but you get to the end of it. It must have been written in or maybe shortly after the time of David. Where did David come from? Book of Ruth answers that. That's the last thing we're told in the book. And so in the book of Ruth in chapter 4, Ruth chapter 4, not only does she live among the Israelites, she marries into the Israelites. So in Ruth chapter 4, verse 18, these are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron was born Ram, and to Ram Amminadab, and to Amminadab was born Nahshon, and to Nahshon Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse David. So keep your finger there and go over to Matthew chapter 1. What's missing there is an important name. Matthew chapter 1, verse 4. Ram was the father of Amminadab. We just read him. Amminadab the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon the father of Salmon, and Salmon was the father of Boaz by Rahab. One other thing I want you to notice about the family into which she married. In Numbers chapter 7, we read the name Nahshon. But in Numbers chapter 7, when the tabernacle, the Israelites were at Mount Sinai for about a year, technically about 9 months. During that time, they build the tabernacle, they build the altar. At the beginning, at the end of the book of Exodus, Leviticus is given to them at that time. At the beginning of the book of Numbers, this is the beginning of the second year, and what they do is they dedicate the tabernacle, right? And remember the elaborate offerings. Each tribe brought an extensive amount of offerings. In Numbers chapter 7, verse 12, now the one who presented his offering on the first day was Nahshon, the son of Amminadab of the tribe of Judah. She married into one of the prominent tribes and one of the prominent families in Israel. He was one of the princes who brings the offering. He's a leader of the nation. Her husband, Salmon, was descended from that family. I don't know what the connection is. Could he have been one of the spies? Possibly. Could he have been one of the families that went and rescued them from the city wall and took them out and helped them resettle? Maybe. I don't really know. But at some point, she marries into one of the noble families in the nation of Israel. That tells me a lot. They saw in this woman something worthy to hang on to. And you remember what the law of Moses said. Go to Deuteronomy. Go to Deuteronomy chapter 21. We might think this is a little bit odd, but in Deuteronomy 21, starting in verse 10, now when you go out to battle against your enemies and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands and you take them away captive, and you see among the captives a beautiful woman and have a desire for her and would like to take her as a wife for yourself, then you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head, trim her nails. She shall remove her clothes, the clothes of her captivity, and remain in your house and mourn her father and mother a full month. And after that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. The fact that she married into the Israelites, the law had already provided for that. She's a POW, prisoner of war. Her family is taken, and she is allowed to come into the family of Israelites. And that's how she gets connected to the Israelites generally. How she gets assimilated into the tribe of Judah, particularly how she gets connected to this family. And then she has a son by the name of Boaz. And Boaz, remember who Boaz married? He married a foreign woman. And they have a son, and eventually they become the ancestors of Jesus. Her place in redemption history is part of her legacy. We read that from Matthew chapter 1. I think that's the most interesting thing. So you have Salmon and Rahab, who have a son, Boaz, who marries a foreign woman by the name of Ruth, and they have a son named Obed. Obed has a son named Jesse. Jesse has a son named David, and David has a descendant who is Jesus of Nazareth. That's her place in the... She starts out as a prostitute and then becomes one of the ancestors of Jesus. But what, there's the family tree, cool. Now, the real thing about her, and this is where she shows up in the New Testament, we've seen her lineage in Matthew 1, but two places in the New Testament, she is commended because of her faith. She's commended because this woman had great faith. Now, you go back to that statement that she makes. We know the Lord God has delivered this city into your hand. He's delivered the whole land. We know what the Lord did. And we know that you're going to come in and wipe us out. That's a great admission, but it's a great confession. She was saying something about the Lord. So in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 31, by faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. She acted on her faith. I want you to think about this. What's the difference between her and all the other people in Jericho? Did she believe something different than them? She said, when we heard what the Lord did, our hearts melt. They all had the same information. You know what the difference was? She acted on the information that she had. She heard something, she believed it, just like I think a lot of her neighbors did. They believed that the Lord was going to come and wipe out the city, but the difference was she acted on what she knew. If you believe everything the Bible says and never do a thing about it, that's on you. That's on you. Don't say that you believe God and then do nothing about it. If you believe in the Lord your God, do something about it. Act on what you know. So she is an example of faith. She's an example of works. She's an example of a faith that is put to work. She didn't just believe it. She acted on it. And everything she did was consistent with that. She put the scarlet cord in the window. She gathered her household. And so she acted on what she knew. It was an example of faith in action. Her faith justified her as well, according to James chapter 2. Now, last couple of things, just a few lessons for us. First of all, this is Mother's Day. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers. How do you get from Rahab to Mother's Day? I've been chewing on that for several weeks now. I picked the brain of my lovely and talented wife and asked her a few things. And so anyway, here's some things I want you to think about. One of the things we learned from Rahab is that your past is a whole lot less important than your future. There's a lot of people who started out pretty bad in the Bible and they wound up pretty good, not because of them, but because of the Lord. God can take anybody and make them part of His family. It doesn't matter what you've done in your past. Turn to the Lord. That's what conversion is. Turn to the Lord and let Him do His work on you. I don't care what choices you've made. I don't care what attitude you've had. I don't care how badly you've messed up anything or everything. Your past, I'm not saying your past is unimportant. Our past shapes us. Even if we turn away from sin and turn to God, your past will continue to affect you in different ways. But your past is a lot less important than your future in Christ. Secondly, if she's singled out for her faith, what does that mean? That means your beliefs shape your choices. She acted on what she knew. She did the right thing. She believed it and she acted on it. Over 12 times in the Gospels, Jesus commends people for their faith. Numerous times He says, your faith has saved you. Her faith saved her. Because she not only believed certain things, she acted on them, and then God took care of the rest. Your beliefs shape your choices. So whether you're choosing a mate, choices about your children, choices about your job, choices about place to live, choices about your friends and other relationships, choices about your finances, you need to make sure that your choices are consistent with what you really believe about the Lord. Third thing is that your family is shaped by your faith. What you believe is going to determine how your family turns out. You need to make sure that you have rock-solid convictions, that you teach your children. You don't need to pass your convictions on to your children. You need to teach your children how to have conviction. Teach them how to become believers. Teach them how to wrestle with Scripture. Teach them how to wrestle with moral choices. Equip them to do that. But your family is shaped by your faith. I think that's such an important thing. One of the things that struck me about Rahab, who is her son? Boaz. Look at how Boaz treated everybody in that story. Boaz is a stark contrast to everybody else in the Judges period. He practiced Leviticus 19:18, love your neighbor as yourself. He treated foreigners with respect. He treated his... There's not a bad person in the book of Ruth. Everybody's polite. They just polite each other to death. Every time you turn around, they're blessing each other. They like each other. And this is the Judges period? What's wrong with these people? I wonder where Boaz got his character from. I'm not denying the role of his dad. But something I've learned, I got three kids. One of them is a son. What he learned about how to treat women, what he learned about how to be respectful, especially toward women, yeah, he learned a little bit from me. He learned a lot from his mom because his mom threatened to kill him if he didn't do it right. I think that's one of the reasons why Boaz has the character that he does. Because of mom. Your family is shaped by your faith and by your character. And then finally, your legacy is shaped by your behavior. Oh, so-and-so was such a, sister so-and-so was just such a good person. How do you know that? You know that by their fruit. How do we know the kind of person that Rahab was? We see what she did. We don't care about what she said. I mean, that's important. But we see the kind of person she was by the choices and actions that she made. That's how people are going to remember you. What did you do with your life? It needs to be dedicated to the Lord. If you're here this morning and you've never obeyed Jesus as Lord, we invite you to make a commitment to Him today. And for those of us that are Christians, we need to make sure that we have the kind of faith Rahab had. That we believe what we're supposed to believe and we do what we're supposed to do. We can help you in any way. We invite you to come forward while we stand and sing.